This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
What's erupting across Israel has been described as a civil war, with Arab and Jewish mobs attacking each other in the streets.
I think we are ruining the fabric of Jewish-Arab relations and joint citizenship that we've been working on for the last 73 years.
Also today, President Biden has a warning for would-be cyber criminals. Washington is ready to beat them at their game, not through one-upmanship, but through collaboration and intelligence sharing.
It's basic, solid housekeeping stuff. There's very little glamorous in this, but that's the right approach.
And Amsterdam is tackling climate change by banning subway ads for gas-guzzling cars.
It makes no sense to keep advertising for something we want to get rid of fast.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to be with you. We begin the program again today with the violence in the Mideast. The militant group Hamas today sent a heavy barrage of rockets from their base in Gaza into Israel. The Israeli military has also been pounding Hamas targets in Gaza with more airstrikes. Since fighting began, at least 7 Israelis have been killed and close to 100 Palestinians. Despite that fraught situation, the back-and-forth shelling is not the main talking point in Israel today. People are focused on the violent riots that erupted between Jewish and Arab mobs. Israeli citizens, Arabs and Jews fighting each other in the streets. Disturbing scenes of savage beatings from both sides. Cars, synagogues, and a Muslim cemetery set on fire. Shops vandalized and looted. Israeli President Reuven Rivlin described what he's seeing, a civil war. Rivlin called into Israeli television and said, "We're under threat of rockets on our citizens and streets, and we're in the midst of a civil war among ourselves. Please, please stop this madness." Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned he was ready to use an iron fist to calm the violence. "This is anarchy," he said. "Nothing can justify it." I spoke earlier today with Mohammed Darosha. He directs a center for a shared society at Givat Haviva, which works to bring Arabs and Jews together. I asked him how he's processing what's unfolding right now in Israel.
Indeed, Marco, these are terrible times. We haven't witnessed something like this, at least not in my lifetime, when the police basically takes a back seat and when political leaders take back seat, mostly playing a role of inciting even. And I'm talking about Jewish and Arab leaders, allowing those mobs to be the ones that take control and use violence. I think we are ruining the fabric of Jewish-Arab relations and joint citizenship that we've been working on for the last 73 years since the creation of the State of Israel. For the first time, there is a political organization of right-wing mobs that come from settlements in the West Bank that choose to arrive into Arab towns and villages and choose confrontation. And unfortunately, the police, they forget that they're supposed to serve and protect all citizens, and they choose to serve and protect the Jewish citizens only. And I think that's a big failure of understanding their mission. And instead of being part of the solution, they actually become part of the problem.
How would you describe what's going on right now? Is it a protest that have turned violent, or is the intent of the people involved actually to riot?
Well, I think it was a protest that turned violent. That's the way we can describe it. People that went to demonstrate, they went to demonstrate to express a perspective. I think most of the public didn't really understand that things could go out of control so quickly, and no one actually expected this to happen. But I think it serves the best interest of Benjamin Netanyahu, and that's why we're not seeing any real attempt to try to stop those incidents.
Also, it sounds like you're saying this violence is not sprouting organically in towns. It's been engineered from other parts of the country. So who are the rioters?
Well, there are two types of rioters. I mean, there are people that happen to be in a demonstration, and it's a demonstration to express a perspective, whether it is against the new policies of prayer or limitations that are put on worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, or people that are opposing the war on Gaza. But many of them get caught in an escalation that could sometimes either driven by some parts of the demonstrators that maybe have a political agenda that they want to serve, or they get attacked by people from outside their towns. Most of the rioters that come to confront the Arab demonstrators in Lud and Akko are not originating from those towns themselves. It's not neighbors standing against each other. It's not this case. I mean, luckily, even in joint buildings of Jews and Arabs that live in the same building, we're not experiencing neighbors turning against each other.
Earlier this week in Lod, as I said, that Arab man who was shot dead in the street by a Jewish neighbor, are you saying that's an exception?
I think that's a very major exception. You know, we're talking about approximately 160,000 Arab citizens that live in mixed cities, and one incident out of 160,000, I think it's a small, disproportionate representation of the reality between Jews and Arabs in the country. But that said, I think that the dynamics on the ground could not last. I mean, the situation right now, if it doesn't end in the next 24 to 48 hours, I think we might experience different kind of dynamics that could expand to things, to the local confrontations between neighboring, actual neighbors that live with each other, that or have lived with each other for many, many years.
I'm speaking with political analyst Mohammed Darousha, focusing on the street riots happening across Israel at the moment. Until Monday, when Hamas began firing rockets into Israel, it seemed like a coalition government that would see Prime Minister Netanyahu leaving office, that it was on the verge of formation. It would have led to, for the first time, Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs cooperating under one government. Have these riots affected that?
Unfortunately, yes. The events of the last 3 days have reduced the possibility of forming a coalition government that will include Arab political parties. Actually, as of this morning, the negotiations between the United Arab List and Yair Lapid, who was mandated by the president to form the government, announced stop of any negotiations into this process, specifically knowing that there are differences in political perspectives, usually between right and left in Israel, and specifically with the Arab political parties that are left of the left of the political scene in Israel, and especially on issues such as the occupation. The Palestinian citizens have strong positions against the occupation and escalation of violence that, as we are witnessing right now in Gaza.
One of your challenges with your organization, the Center for a Shared Society at Givat Haviva, is creating precisely that equitable society between Muslims, Jews, between people of all faiths. So as you look at the current situation, how do you do that?
That's a big question right now. But we know three things that need to be to happen. One is to create dialogue. I think that the national politicians are part of the problem, and we're counting more on the local politicians, in the local leaders, in the local educators, the local business people that suffer from those type of incidents and have direct interest to prevent this from happening. The second is to break the divide. Jews and Arabs, unfortunately, live separate lives. And if we have any interaction, it's mostly what I would call 9-to-5 interaction, working together. But after 5 p.m., we go to separate social structures. We go to separate communities, separate residential neighborhoods and towns and villages. We do not have enough integration and enough cooperation on the social arenas. And the third component, I think, is to strengthen mixed businesses and mixed interests and mixed infrastructures. So the more we create partnerships between the communities, the more we force them to continue working together. We have to actually today expand our work. We have to make sure that it's not just education for shared society, which is putting the burden of peace building on the shoulders of children. We need to put the burden on the shoulders of the adults that are running the show in Jewish and Arab neighboring municipalities.
Mohammed Darosha is a political analyst, also directs the Center for a Shared Society at Givat Haviva, where he works to bring Arabs and Jews together. Mohammed, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Eid al-Fitr began last night. It's the Muslim holiday marking the end of Ramadan, the holy month of reflection and fasting. We asked you how you were celebrating and to share part of your day with us.
Hey, the world. My name is Mary Johnson. I'm calling from Springfield, Massachusetts. And I'm here making the breaking the fast meal and iftar for my family right now. I've been home a lot more this Ramadan than I have been in Ramadan's past because I left my job due to the pandemic. So this Ramadan, I've really gotten a chance to cook a lot more. My husband's from Morocco. I made some special Moroccan dishes. There's a special Ramadan, like an energy powder that they make in Morocco called Safouf. And I made that this year, and it has almonds and sunflower seeds and sesame seeds and all different types of spices. And then you add traditionally butter and honey to it to sweeten it and make it moist. But I add olive oil and maple syrup. So I New Englandize it. And so I've really enjoyed, you know, having that with my family. Eid Mubarak, happy Eid.
I'm Marco. My name is Shahid Henderson. I'm from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, currently living in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. And we've been living here in the region for approximately 20 years now. And for the Eid al-Fitr, my family, we normally have American breakfast as a tradition. So after the morning prayer or Eid prayer, we'll go for American breakfast and we'll normally give the kids gifts and treats in order to make the event joyful and joyous for them. We try to make it as fun as possible for the kids and make it a memorable experience.
Hi, my name is Messina Henderson. I'm 20 years old and I was raised in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, but I currently live in North Carolina, USA. So one of my favorite things about Eid has got to be the Salat al-Eid, or the Eid prayer. Not only is it unique in the way that it's performed, but the feelings of community and celebration that come along with it are amazing to me. The preparations and lead up to the prayer definitely also play a role. Things like picking out the perfect Eid outfit, making goodie bags with my siblings to pass out at the masjid or the mosque. Even the anticipation of walking or driving to the mosque adds to the excitement in a way. Performing the Eid prayer is by far one of my favorite aspects of Eid.
I'm Dr. Omar Habib. I'm an American expatriate who lives in Auckland, New Zealand. Traditionally, Eid is a time when Muslims come together to celebrate, exchange gifts, and enjoy some delicious eats after a month of fasting for Ramadan. But in 2021, as we now surpass one full year into the COVID-19 pandemic, I'll simply be celebrating the fact that I was able to safely observe Ramadan in the first place. I'm very lucky to be living in New Zealand, which has been at or near the top of COVID resilience ranking measures since the beginning of the pandemic. My relatives in India will not be celebrating Eid the way that I will be able to over Zoom from New Zealand this year. The one gift I wish I could give everyone for Eid this year is the vaccine. It's simply not enough that only 4% of the world's population is fully vaccinated at this point. Inshallah, we'll be celebrating the success of our worldwide vaccination efforts for Eid 2022.
Thanks to you, our listeners, for sharing your Eid celebrations and hopes with us. Our story was produced by Amanda McGowan and Uzair Emoud. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. All day, every day, we're bombarded with ads, things to buy, food to eat, places to go. An effort to change those ads to shift attitudes around the environment is the focus of today's Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Amsterdam this month became the first city to say no to one specific type of advertising on its subway system, the ones promoting fossil fuels. The World's Anna Kussmer reports.
Central Station in Amsterdam looks like other subway stops around the world. You have your ticket machines and escalators taking riders deep underground to catch their train. On the platform, TV screens play video ads to the millions of weekly passengers stuck there waiting.
You have, as an advertiser, have a lot of time to tell your story.
Radjan van Vilsum is the CEO of CS Digital Media, the company that places ads in the metro. Starting last week, they stopped advertising products with high carbon footprints, like gas-guzzling cars and cheap flights from airlines like EasyJet.
We don't tell you can fly to Barcelona for 19 euros. We don't do that anymore.
Van Vilsum says they're also giving discounts to companies promoting electric vehicles and renewable energy.
It's not about the ban of the fossil fuels. That was just a step. It was more opening up more ad space and giving benefits to advertisers to tell how we move forward in changing the environment.
About 10% of ads previously placed in the metro will now be banned, and Van Vilsum expects the change to cost the company millions. This ban was enacted by the Amsterdam City Council, introduced by Green Party member Jasper Huyn.
A majority of the Dutch populace accepts that climate change is a real problem and that something should be done about it, but they're not at the point where a majority is willing to accept the measures we have to take, like flying less or eating less meat.
He says he hopes the ad ban will start to change that. It's part of a greater effort in Amsterdam to cut CO2 emissions 55% by 2030. And Huyn says he hopes to expand it citywide and eventually beyond.
What I would hope that doing so in Amsterdam would be an example to other cities in the Netherlands or maybe other cities worldwide.
Huyn says some city councillors oppose the ban on the grounds of free speech.
They use the slippery slope argument. They say, well, what's next? Now you're forbidding fossil fuels and next thing you will be banning advertising for meat because you also say that's bad for the environment.
Inspiration for the ban came from activists like George Unki Hong from a group called Fossil Free Advertising.
The Dutch name is Reclame Fossielvrij.
They want a national ban.
All advertising for tobacco is prohibited, and we are striving towards a tobacco-style law.
Studies from Myanmar, China, and the U.S. show seeing ads for tobacco leads to more smoking, particularly in children. And ad bans have led to less smoking in many countries, according to the World Health Organization. Unki Hung says, like tobacco, oil and gas are harmful, so the government shouldn't encourage their use.
It makes no sense to keep advertising for something we want to get rid of fast.
While Amsterdam is the first place to do this, the French Parliament is considering a similar ban, and activists in the UK, Sweden, Finland, and Canada are pushing for one too. Maureen Meachs is an environmental communication researcher at the University of Amsterdam. She says there hasn't been much research on the connection between ad bans and individual actions for climate change. But she thinks a ban like this could contribute to subtle cultural shifts.
It might change how we think of taking a flight, taking a bigger car, and it might change the perceptions within society slowly. I wouldn't say it doesn't have an effect, but it might not have huge, large, direct effects.
Meir says there is evidence that when people see their government acting on climate change, it can increase their own motivation to act. But the ban doesn't address certain underlying problems.
It's a nice middle ground. It can green our consumption, but in the end, it cannot really stop our consumption, which would be more effective.
Ending consumerism? Probably too big of a lift for a subway platform. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
Every day, people across the globe have become accustomed to putting on a mask, and then they take them off. Now you see them on the ground, on sidewalks, in parks. They belong in the trash, since most COVID masks are supposed to be one-use and disposable, but made partly from plastic, they're not going to break down and disintegrate anytime soon. This bothered Dutch graphic artist Marianne de Groot Pons, so she came up with a biodegradable alternative, a mask made of rice paper, with a hidden extra in there, flower seeds. Mariana, what are the flower seeds in the mask about? Let's start there. And what kind of flowers are they?
Yeah, I was stumbling for weeks over all these blue masks. And I thought, okay, this is not good. Yeah, will it work out when I put some seeds in them and make the fabric biodegradable? So after use, you can plant them. And my goal is to bloom the world.
So the seeds are in the mask. You bury the whole mask, right?
You bury the whole mask, yes. Also the straps and the rosettes, everything you can plant in your garden or flower pot.
And what kind of flowers are in the masks?
It's a kind of meadow mix, asters, cornflower, gilia, dill.
And the mask straps as well, they are also biodegradable?
Yes, they're pure wool, so they're 100% degradable. And they're just only washed in a river, so they're not with chemicals at all, so they're just pure wool.
So how effective is it at preventing the transmission of COVID? I mean, is it at the standard of like the KN95 masks?
No. It's you can compare them with the homemade fabric masks. So they've not been tested. Yeah, you compare them with the homemade masks.
Mm. How did you come up with this idea for a rice paper mask?
I'm a graphic designer, so I'm a creative person, and all the pollution makes me really sad. So I thought we have to wear all these masks. So is it possible to do something creative with these masks so that they're not bad for Earth? And that was the start of these masks.
So I was reading one of the reasons you created this biodegradable mask, that you were kind of atoning for your 10-year stint with Unilever, the British consumer goods company. What did you do for Unilever?
I work for a graphic designer for 20 years, so for several brands, not only Unilever, also other brands. And I made some packaging made from plastic. So it could be possible that there is one bottle in an ocean with my design on it. And I that thought made me think, okay, now that's not good. So stop with all these plastics and do something good with my job as a graphic designer.
How many masks are you selling each month at this point?
We just started in February. We're working on the kitchen table. That's where this whole project started. So
wow.
We were really proud that we could produce 100 masks each night. But now we are connected with a real producer. So we have 30 people working on this project.
And how many have you sold in the last 2 months?
In the last 2 months, we sold 50,000 masks.
Wow. That's impressive.
Incredible. Yeah, I've never dreamed that it worked out this way. I thought, okay, it's only for friends and family, but now everybody all around the world is calling me and ask me, oh, could you please send them?
How much do you charge for these masks, these rice paper masks?
They are in a box with five, and then they are 15 euros.
So about $20 for five masks. And if I wanted to order one, could I do that?
Not yet. We would love to bloom US too. And so the US people need to be patient, but so we're working on it.
Mariana de Goedpons is a Dutch graphic artist who has come up with a biodegradable face mask made of rice paper, and it comes with flower seeds. She's been speaking with us from Utrecht in the Netherlands. Mariana, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to The World. Relics of 16th century West Africa are on display in Western museums. Activists want museum directors to ask themselves,
why do we have all these things, especially if there's all this information about how violently they were expropriated from these places?
How that question's being answered, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. After several high-profile hacks, the Biden administration is taking steps to strengthen the nation's cybersecurity.
I think it's becoming clear to everyone that we have to do more than being done now.
That's President Biden speaking today. Yesterday, he signed an executive order that his administration hopes will fortify the country's digital defenses. The World's Lydia Manalidou has our story.
For the last few months, the U.S. has been hit with one cyber crisis after another.
A new warning tonight about the scope of a massive cyber attack.
Already believed to be the largest
cyber attack
and may have exposed information from some of the highest levels of government.
So first, there was SolarWinds, where Russian state-backed hackers exploited a vulnerability in software used by U.S. federal agencies and broke into their networks, likely for espionage. Then there was Microsoft Exchange, where Chinese state-linked hackers used a hole in the email software to infiltrate the servers of thousands of organizations. And of course, these days, it's Colonial Pipeline.
As the largest oil pipeline in the country remains closed,
a cyber criminal gang with ties to Eastern Europe, potentially Russia, hacked into the company's systems and forced them to shut down for days. President Biden has blamed his predecessor for America's weakened cyber defenses.
The truth is this. The Trump administration failed to prioritize cybersecurity.
This is Biden in December.
In an age when so much of our lives are conducted online, cyber attacks must be treated as a serious threat by our leadership at the highest levels.
But the president himself has also been criticized for not moving fast enough to guard the country against cyber intrusions. The executive order he signed yesterday is one of his first big moves on the cyber front. The White House wants to do a number of things, like create a cyber safety review board that will look into big hacks when they happen, kind of like the National Transportation Safety Board does when there's a train derailment or plane crash. Biden also wants to mandate more collaboration and intelligence sharing between private companies and the U.S. government so that cyber intrusions are detected and handled promptly. None of this is particularly flashy or sexy.
It's basic, solid housekeeping stuff. There's very little glamorous in this executive order, but that's the right approach.
Kieran Martin used to be the UK's top cyber official at the National Cybersecurity Centre there. He says, however technical and unglamorous, the executive order in the US is a leap forward.
You know, the biggest thing any rich, advanced country, particularly the most powerful nation on earth, can do in the digital age to protect its security, these incremental improvements.
For example, Martin is glad to see that the U.S. wants tougher security standards for software that's used by federal government agencies. He says the buying power of the federal government is strong. Companies want contracts with the feds, and stricter requirements for them could lead to a bigger industry shift so that the software and programs you and I, regular consumers, use are more secure.
There is a sort of trickle-down impact on this, not just actually within the US, but in the wider Western world as well.
The US action comes at a critical time, says Bart Rotheis. He's former head of cybersecurity for the Dutch Ministry of Defense. Now he's a member of the European Parliament. He says cyber attacks by state actors and criminal groups are rising exponentially.
And we haven't reached our peak yet, so it's a new pandemic, and we have to make sure that we guard ourselves against such attacks.
He says recent cyber attacks have put Europe on edge, too. He's leading an effort to draft EU-wide cybersecurity legislation. And he says it's crucial that the U.S. and the EU are aligned on cybersecurity standards.
The U.S. is seen as a very important ally for all European countries. And we're restoring, I think, after the Trump era, some of the relationships that we had. And that's very good and it's very positive.
He and other experts will be carefully watching to see how the U.S. puts the new executive order into practice, because a more secure U.S. means a better ally in cyberspace. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
In Russia, feminism is not widely accepted. To many there, it's a Western concern. Gender equality is just not a priority for many in Russia. For Tatiana Nikonova, that status quo was unacceptable. Nikonova was a pioneering feminist activist, sex education blogger, and supporter of LGBT rights in Russia. Yesterday, according to a message on her website, Nikonova died suddenly due to illness. She was 43. I spoke with St. Petersburg-based journalist and feminist activist Bella Rappaport and asked her what Tatiana Nikonova represented for Russian feminists.
She represented feminism, Russian feminism. She represented sexual freedom. She represented the invention of the new language talking about sex. I remember the times when she was the only one who was speaking about these topics.
She wrote a blog that broke open a lot of taboos, right?
Yeah, right. And we didn't know there were different kinds of sex toys. We didn't speak about menstruation. And she was almost the only one who was doing that back then, like 7 years ago. Now we have a lot of sex bloggers, and all of them are inspired by her activity.
What has the response been in Russia since her death?
Yeah, I cannot say for the whole Russia, but all of the people that I know, they are really grateful to her. Some people want to continue her heritage, you know, all the feminists in grief because she was an inspiration for them.
Bella, how do you see gender roles in Russia and what needs changing?
Russia is big. As every country, you have a lot of cultures inside of the big culture. I watch the TikTok videos which the youth are doing, and I see that they are crushing toxic masculinity and homophobia and sexism. And both young men and women and non-binary persons, they are doing it on TikTok. So our, for example, law on gay propaganda doesn't work for them. But we also have this conservative turn. Our government is always trying to forbid abortions, forbid the information about homosexuality. I'm a lesbian, for example, and of course I'm fighting this law since 2013.
And that's the anti-gay propaganda law.
Right. This has to be changed, and conception of strong men and weak women has to be changed, but it's changing actually.
Yeah, so you and the late Tatiana Nikonova are contemporaries. What does the next wave of Russian feminism need to tackle?
I think they should continue spreading the information and living their lives as they want, because everybody has to learn that you don't have to be an activist to be a feminist or to be a happy woman. Because if you think that you have to be activist, it causes depression, and I know how it is. So living their lives and spread the information, and even if you are defending your boundaries on your work or in your class with your partner, you are already doing something for feminism and for yourself.
Journalist and feminist activist Bella Rappaport speaking with us from St. Petersburg about Tatiana Nikonova, renowned Russian feminist activist who died yesterday at the age of 43. Bella, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you.
New cases of COVID-19 remain stubbornly high in India, nearly 400,000 new reported infections a day. That's about half of the daily total for the entire planet. Indian hospitals remain full and critical medical supplies low. Rukmini S. is a data journalist in Chennai. She spent much of the past year producing a podcast called The Moving Curve, tracking the impact of the coronavirus in her country. Rukmini, what are the latest trends in India? Where are cases rising and falling right now?
India has been seeing over 400,000 new cases now for the last few days. And as you would expect, when cases go high, deaths have been rising steadily too. There are now over 4,000 deaths being reported each day. For the last week or so, there's been a slight appearance of a plateau in India's total numbers. And this is being driven by a couple of large states in particular, where the second wave began a bit earlier and are now beginning to see something of a peak.
What about the vaccine rollout? Are vaccinations starting to put a dent in the number of new cases anywhere in India?
Across the country, states are reporting massive vaccine shortages. This is particularly unfortunate because in the little data that we do have, there's already potential signs of something of a vaccine effect. For example, the share of the elderly in total deaths has begun to fall sharply. It does appear that there is something of a vaccine effect evident in the outcomes for the elderly.
When we're counting infections and deaths, how do your numbers compare with the official numbers from the government?
So it's very clear that there is an underestimation. We knew going into the pandemic that India has a sort of history of failing to accurately count infections and deaths in communicable diseases. We know this from other data sources. There's very clear evidence of pressure being put for numbers to be kept as artificially low as possible. The way this is being done is that India has adopted one of the most stringent definitions of what constitutes a COVID death, which is completely goes against both what the WHO has recommended and what India's own official documents say. So unless a person was lucky enough to get a COVID positive test prior to death and then happened to die in a hospital of very clearly COVID symptoms, he or she will not be registered as a COVID death in India.
I mean, that mismatch totally scans with some grim reports I've been seeing about bodies washing up on the shores of the Ganges, COVID victims. So what are your thoughts about how to cut through the bureaucratic chaos and get a more accurate count of infections and deaths?
What the government could do is sort of, if it sent out a message to all authorities that reporting higher numbers of COVID deaths doesn't mean that you are failing. It could mean that you are succeeding at reporting and there won't be a pushback. You won't have to pay for it. It's possible that authorities would feel better empowered to more accurately report numbers.
Rukmini, why did you start your podcast, The Moving Curve? When you rolled out the first episode, what were you responding to? I mean, it wasn't a crisis like it is now, was it?
What I was responding to at the time was in part the isolation and confusion of the beginning of India's extremely stringent lockdown in March 2020. It came, as you remember, with 4 hours of warning and everyone's right. lives were completely thrown in disarray. And it really was a sense of being really unmoored from all that was familiar. And the idea was to sort of distill all the information that was coming in, remove all the sensationalism and all the partisan bickering that was already going on over it, and to provide some sort of calm distillation of what I was hearing.
Your expertise, of course, is data, but you're also living this pandemic. How do you reconcile the numbers on your spreadsheets with just the human toll of the crisis outside your window?
When I look at a particular city and I look at its death toll for a particular day, and I know that a friend is actually among those numbers, as has happened recently, it really brings home the fact that all of those numbers are someone's friends or family. And, you know, there's a great sense of grievance and anger having lost friends and having had family who is even currently ill. It really brings home to me this information has to be demanded from the government.
Rukmini S. is a data journalist based in Chennai and host of the podcast Tracking India's Pandemic, The Moving Curve. Rukmini, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marco.
There's another COVID-related story in India that connects to the sea. You could argue Indians rule the oceans. Across all the world's tankers and container ships, about one-third of the officers working on board are from India. But the spread of COVID in their home country has been impacting their livelihoods. Abdul Ghani Sarang is General Secretary of the National Union of Seafarers of India. He's in Mumbai. He told us that some countries are not allowing Indian crew members to leave their ships, which means some Indian mariners are forced to stay longer at sea, while other Indians are stuck on shore waiting for the chance to work.
To go on board the ship and to come down from that merchant ship, a cargo carrying ship, is very challenging. A regular contract is around 8 to 9 months, but the seafarers, because of the COVID pandemic, they had to continue to extend their contracts because there were restrictions in place. The ease of going on board the ship, coming down after their contracts, and also shore leave, and there are certain restrictions put in by some countries. So that is all affecting the seafarers, you know, mentally and also at times physically.
What countries are not permitting seafarers from India right now?
You see, it started with Singapore, then Hong Kong, and then, you know, the list carried on. But there are still countries who take in, like, they allow the seafarers to come in. UK, if you're a seafarer, you can still join the ship.
For seafarers who can't go to sea, there's an economic impact, I imagine, on themselves and their families.
Any days sitting at home adds to your, you know, to your frustration, and they're eating into their reserves and they are going into minus also and taking loans and borrowing money. So this is very challenging for them. They are in a very, very tight situation if they are not able to get back on the ship for their next round of gainful employment.
Abdul Ghani, in your leadership role at the National Union of Seafarers of India, do you have suggestions for other measures to ensure seafarers are not bringing COVID on board with them, creating that confidence for other ports of call?
You see, we have asked our government, we have been very consistent with our government for those priority for the vaccination, the COVID vaccination, that all seafarers, all ranks of seafarers should get that COVID vaccination on priority. And that is what will give the confidence to the others who have, you know, decided to not allow Indian seafarers to come in. So that is the measure which we are working closely with the Maritime Administration and the other stakeholders.
I mean, given the problems with the vaccination rollout generally across India, are you confident that seafarers will be able to get those vaccines in time?
What we have been doing, we have been directly dealing with the company which produces the vaccine. So we are in touch with them and we are very sanguine that we will get a batch or this thing, large number on our own. We'll purchase it from the company and we'll have it distributed to our seafarers free of cost.
Is the National Union of Seafarers able to actually purchase vaccines?
Yeah. Their discussions are going on. So we should get some positive results soon.
Abdul Ghani Sarong, General Secretary of the National Union of Seafarers of India, speaking with us from Mumbai. Thank you very much and good luck with your job and getting those vaccines.
Thank you so much.
What happens when a shark goes to college? Yeah, it sounds like the start of a bad joke. It's what scientists in New South Wales, Australia, thought they saw last week. That's when the GPS signal from a research tag on a 6-foot-long bull shark started pinging from the grounds of the University of Wollongong. Of course, a shark had not enrolled in college. The tag on its fin popped off, as it's designed to do. Normally, scientists simply retrieve the tags when they wash up on the beach, but a well-meaning owner of a campus cafe who was picking up beach litter beat them to it, the tag ending up back on campus where he dumped the trash. You may now stop humming the theme to Jaws. The Benin bronzes, they're not from Benin, and most of them are not bronze. They're more than 1,000 brass sculptures and plaques made from the 16th century onwards in the historical West African kingdom of Benin, present-day Nigeria. The bronzes once decorated the royal palace and are regarded as one of Africa's greatest artistic treasures. Thing is, they're not in Africa. They're in European and American museums, despite repeated calls for their return. Now Germany will be the first to do that. Activists hope that this will be the beginning of an unstoppable movement. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
In 1897, British colonial forces attacked the Kingdom of Benin. They burned down towns and villages and massacred the residents. When they got to the capital, they ransacked the royal palace, taking ivory, wooden carvings, masks, plaques, and reliefs. The British shipped the loot back to London and sold it off. Today, the objects are on display in some of the most famous museums in Europe and the United States. The Benin bronzes were stolen more than 100 years ago, but for many, it's a theft that still hurts. In songs like this, you can hear the pain. This is a Nigerian folk song about the 1897 siege. And you can hear the anger. A rap from a Nigerian musician, Monday Midnight, who lives in England. For many people inside and outside Africa, the Benin bronzes are symbols of colonialism and exploitation, and they'll stay that way until they're returned.
Since the early 1960s, the Nigerian government and authorities have been pressing for restitution of Benin bronzes.
This is Princeton professor Chika Okeke-Ogulu, and he's been part of the restitution effort.
And all through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, these demands had not abated.
Museums have given a range of excuses over the years for why they couldn't possibly give back the bronzes. In the 70s and 80s, they said that African museums didn't have the resources to care for the artifacts. And more recently, they argued there's no legal framework for returning them. But in the wake of global protests against racism over the past few years, museum experts say attitudes are changing. In a historic first, Germany, which has the second largest collection of Benin bronzes in the world, has committed to start returning them by 2022. the bronzes will be housed in a new museum in Benin City in Nigeria. Barbara Plankensteiner has been instrumental in the negotiations. She is the founding member of the Benin Dialogue Group, a consortium of European and Nigerian museums that's been working towards restitution for a decade. She says the negotiations have been complicated, not least because in Germany, the decision to return artifacts isn't actually up to the museums. It's up to the government.
Basically, all of the collections are publicly owned by various federal states or municipalities. If items from public collections are deaccessioned or returned, it is a major political process.
But at a certain point, she says, everyone agreed that the moral considerations outweighed the logistical ones.
There is a political understanding in Germany that this needs to happen. And I think 10 years ago, that was not the case.
Over those 10 years, says Chika Okeke-Agulu, there's been a changing of the guard as old school museum curators and politicians have retired and a new generation has taken their place.
These days, museum administrators are beginning to wonder, why do we have all these things, especially if there's all this information about how violently they were expropriated from these places? Why are we not doing something about that?
After Germany's big announcement, all eyes are on the British Museum, which has the largest collection of Benin bronzes in the world. The British haven't committed to anything publicly, but Okeke-Ogulu says he thinks they're well on their way. They're also in the Benin Dialogue Group and raising funds for the new museum in Benin City.
They're in. I don't see how they're going to back out.
No, the holdouts are closer to home. Our home, that is.
The Americans are the ostriches. They've been hiding their head in the sand.
Museums like the Met in New York, the Smithsonian in Washington, all have Benin bronzes, and they're not making any moves toward letting them go. Okeke-Ogulu says American museums are trying to morally distance themselves with various claims like,
we were not an African empire. It's the problem of the Europeans. They need to sort it out. These are arguments that American museums have made for the longest time.
But time might be up for the U.S. If protests over racial justice across the world tell us anything, it's that American museums can be ostriches no longer. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Several months ago, the city of Krakow, Poland, realized it had a problem. It needed a musician, someone to play the trumpet. Not just any old trumpet player, the gig had specific requirements. In addition to being skilled on the horn, the ideal candidate would have to pass a fitness test, be a Polish citizen, have graduated from high school, and not be afraid of heights. Yep, because the job involves climbing 272 steps to the top of the church tower of St. Mary's Basilica that overlooks Krakow's main market square. The highlight of the job, if you can call it that, requires taking part in the Heno, which means bugle call. It's a Krakow tradition that goes back to at least the 14th century. It's played on the hour, every hour, 24 hours a day. The noon performance is aired on state-run Polish radio and has been since 1927. These days, a seven-trumpeter team works 24-hour periods with 2 days off between each shift. The Heno music is made up of just 5 notes and ends abruptly, and that's on purpose. Legend goes that in 1241, a trumpeter sounding the alarm was hit by an arrow from an invading Tatar, hence the trumpet interruptus. On the hiring front, we have some news to report. After 6 months and 2 rounds of recruitment, a spokesman for the trumpet team announced that they have found not one, but 2 men, it appears to be a male-only thing, to join them. I suppose that'll take pressure off scheduling, a bit. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. You be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.